My name is Caroline Ahrens, and I'm CEO of Lyngby Taarbæk City of Knowledge, and I have the privilege to welcome you all here tonight in Microsoft's new domicile in Lyngby. This is going to be a very special evening with Andreas Mogensen, Denmark's first ESA astronaut. Lyngby Taarbæk City of Knowledge, FOF Copenhagen, and Microsoft have worked together in order to invite you to this exciting lecture here in Lyngby tonight. And we're particularly pleased that we can welcome you, Andreas Mogensen, Denmark's one and only ESA astronaut. So tonight we will hear about your space adventure last September when you traveled into space to the International Space Station ISS. So without further ado, I give you Andreas Mogensen.
Thank you. Thank you, and good evening and welcome. Next week, it will be exactly 9 months ago that I was on my first mission in space on board the International Space Station, ISS. And I want to, of course, use a big part of the next hour talking to you a little bit about the mission and some of the exciting research that I performed on board the space station. But I also want to go a little bit further back in time and tell you how I became fascinated with space exploration and with science, and how this dream of becoming an astronaut started for me. And then I also want to use a little bit of time to tell you a little bit more about the European Space Agency. I'm sure that all of you have heard or know of NASA, but perhaps not all of you have heard of ESA. And that's a bit of a shame, because ESA is our common European space agency, and we do a lot of very interesting things apart from human spaceflight. And so hopefully you'll leave tonight with a better understanding of the European Space Agency and some of the activities that we're involved in as well. But I want to start with this picture. This is a picture that I took from the space station. It's taken from what's called Cupola, which is our big window that points down towards the Earth. It's actually 7 windows put together, and then it forms this panorama window, and you can sit in there almost entirely and then look down at our beautiful planet. And it's where most of the astronauts love to spend their free time taking pictures, and then typically when they return to Earth after their mission, they spend a lot of time talking about what a beautiful sight it is to see our planet from space. And there's no question, it is a beautiful sight, but something that struck me as just as beautiful was sitting in Cupola looking out at the night sky and looking out of the universe, because from the space station you can see billions and billions of stars, and it's just an incredible sight. When you sit there in Cupola and look out at the night sky, you very quickly get a sensation of how large, almost infinitely large, the universe is. And very quickly you also get a sensation of how small and almost insignificant the Earth and all of us on the Earth are. And that actually made me optimistic, because when something is as large, almost infinitely large, like the universe, it must mean that there are so many possibilities, so many opportunities, so many exciting discoveries waiting for us in the future in space. Because even though Neil Armstrong in 1969, when he first set foot on the moon, said that it was a giant leap for mankind, seen in relation to how big the distances are within our own solar system and within our own galaxy, what we did back then was take a very, very small step, and we've only just now truly begun the exploration of space. And so I'm certain that in the future we'll make a lot of very exciting discoveries. For me, the fascination of space began back in the fourth or fifth grade when I, for the first time in my life, learned about NASA and the American astronauts. And in particular, of course, the Apollo missions to the moon fascinated me. And that's really what woke or started this dream within me of becoming an astronaut. Back then, of course, it was the sense of adventure, the personal experience of traveling into space, of being weightless, of exploring new worlds that fascinated me. And it was also along the same time that the movie Top Gun with Tom Cruise came out, and I thought, you know, that was the coolest movie ever. And I wanted to be a fighter pilot just like Tom Cruise. And it actually fit really well with this dream of becoming an astronaut, because traditionally, back in the 60s, 70s, and even the 80s, most astronauts started their careers as fighter pilots, then they became test pilots, and then they ended as astronauts. So that's what I figured I would do as well. But already within a few years, in particular in seventh grade, when I had biology and geology in school for the first time, I also became interested in science. And thinking back to seventh grade, there's in particular one thing that I remember learning about, and which kind of was the first time where I realized what science can be used for, what the scientific method is all about. And it's when I learned about what's called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is one of the places on the Earth where two of Earth's tectonic plates move away from each other. And then magma, flowing magma, comes up to the surface deep from within the Earth. And this molten magma, when it reaches the sea, it freezes and forms new ocean floor or new Earth crust. And what's so interesting about this magma is that it contains iron particles. And these iron particles, they align with the Earth's magnetic field. And when we look at the seafloor, what we see are these different bands where the iron particles have changed direction. And it shows clearly how the Earth's magnetic North Pole and magnetic South Pole have swapped places throughout history. And when we look at how fast these tectonic plates are moving away from each other, we can also begin to say something about how often the magnetic poles have swapped places. And that was the first time I realized that just by looking at the world around us and making observations and testing those hypotheses formed on those observations, we could begin to understand things like this, even though they've happened hundreds of thousands of years in the past. And I thought this was really, really fascinating. The Earth's magnetic field is also something that's interested us in Denmark a lot. Denmark's first and so far only satellite mission, Ørsted, that was sent up in 1999, had the goal of studying Earth's magnetic field. And based on the experiences that we got from the Ørsted mission, it has allowed us in Denmark to be the leading players behind one of ESA's current missions called SWARM. The SWARM mission is currently orbiting the Earth. It consists of three satellites flying in formation, and the goal of SWARM is to give us a deeper understanding of Earth's magnetic field, how it's influenced by external factors like the solar wind, and also what kind of changes we can expect. And when we look at the data that we're currently receiving from the SWARM missions, we see that the strength of the magnetic field is currently falling. And that could suggest that within the next couple hundred thousand years, the magnetic North Pole and South Pole will once again swap places. What that means for Earth, or what effect it has on life on Earth, we don't really know. So this is one area that we're still very much interested in understanding more about and studying more at ESA, as well as here in Denmark. My interest in science grew steadily with every year, and in particular in ninth grade when I had physics and chemistry for the first time, I really became fascinated with space. And this was also the first time I started reading popular science books. And one of the first books I read was a book called In Search of Schrodinger's Cat, which is about astrophysics and the universe. And it fascinated me back then. And there's one thing in particular, which even to this day is a bit of a mystery to us. And that is, if we look out at the universe and we count everything that we can see, then what we would call normal matter, the matter that I'm made of, the matter that you're made of, the matter that this building is made of, constitutes only about 5% of the universe. Then there's about 25% that we call dark matter, and then about 70% that we call dark energy. Why do we call it dark matter and dark energy? Well, because we don't really know what it is and we have to call it something. So we've decided to call it dark matter and dark energy. But again, you know, this makes me optimistic for the future, especially there are any budding scientists out there, because if we only know 5% of the universe, if 95% of the universe is still unknown to us, it must mean that in the future, you know, there are a lot of exciting discoveries waiting for us. And of course, this is also an area that we're very interested in knowing more about at the European Space Agency, And within the last few years, we've had two different missions, Herschel and Planck, in space with the purpose of understanding how the universe started, how it's formed with time, and what it's made of today. These two missions, Herschel and Planck, they're essentially space telescopes where the main instrument is a mirror, and this mirror was designed and built partially here in Denmark. So these are missions that we've also been heavily involved with from Danish side. So two very, very exciting missions with Danish involvement as well. Later, when I went to high school and university, I also became fascinated with Mars. And Mars is a really, really interesting planet, which once I've explained this map, you can also see from this map. This is one of my favorite maps for Mars. It's an elevation map that shows the difference in surface height. The blue colors corresponds to low-lying areas. So this is here, the purple colors is -8 kilometers. And then the yellow, red, and white colors are corresponding to high elevation areas. And when you look at this map, one of the first things you notice is that in many ways, Mars is composed of two different hemispheres kind of put together. There's the northern hemisphere up here, which is comprised mostly of lowlands. And then on the left, upper left, you have the southern hemisphere, which is principally highlands. Another thing you notice when you look down here on this part of the map, you see on the northern hemisphere, there are very few craters. And that reminds us a lot of the Earth. If we go outside and look around us here, we don't see very many craters on Earth. And the reason we don't do that is because we have geological processes here on Earth. We have wind, water, and weather that help to erase the craters after they formed. On the southern hemisphere of Mars, on the other hand, we see lots and lots of craters. And it reminds us a lot of the Moon. And on the Moon, there are a lot of craters because there's no weather phenomena. There's no water. There's no wind. Or other types of weather. So once a crater has formed on Mars, it's there for almost eternity. Statistically, there ought to be just as many craters on the northern hemisphere of Mars as on the southern hemisphere. So that must mean that there's been some kind of process that has erased these craters after they were formed. And that process could possibly be flowing water. We have many other signs that point to the fact that millions or billions of years ago in the past, Mars had flowing water or liquid water on its surface. And that's very, very exciting because we think that liquid water is one of the prerequisites for life. So if there was liquid water on Mars in the past, maybe there was also life. And I'm not thinking about intelligent aliens. I'm thinking about bacteria, microorganisms, and other life like that. And of course, this is an area that we're also very interested in knowing more about at the European Space Agency, which is why just a couple of months ago, we launched the first half of our ExoMars mission, which will arrive at Mars in the next, I think, approximately 5 or 6 months. This first half of the ExoMars mission is comprised of a satellite that'll orbit Mars and then a stationary lander that's going to land on the surface of Mars. And then 4 years from now, in 2020, we're going to send the second half of the ExoMars mission to Mars, and that's this rover that you see behind me, which will land on Mars and then drive around looking for signs of water and signs of life. And it'll do that with, among other things, a drill that can drill 1 or 2 meters down in the surface of Mars and analyze that soil for signs of water and life. This drill was tested by a Danish company called GomSpace, and there's also some other Danish companies that have helped to develop some of the software that the ExoMars mission relies on. So also a mission that we've contributed to here in Denmark. At this point in high school and at university, I realized that my fascination with science and in particular space exploration was so great that I kind of gave up the idea of becoming a fighter pilot, and I decided I wanted to be an aerospace engineer instead, because then I could work with satellites and other spacecraft that we send out into space, even if I couldn't be an astronaut myself. I quickly realized that the chances of becoming an astronaut were, after all, minimal. But I figured, as an aerospace engineer, at least I could still work with space exploration. So that's what I did. But then in 2008, I was lucky that the European Space Agency hired, or were looking to hire, new astronauts for the first time since 1992. And together with about 10,000 other Europeans, I applied. And after a full year of grueling tests, psychological tests, medical tests, cognitive tests, everything you can possibly imagine, I was one of six lucky new European astronauts that started in 2009. And since 2009, I've been training at the European Astronaut Center in Cologne, Germany, preparing for spaceflight, which, lucky for me, happened last year in September when I spent 10 days in space on board the space station. But even today, I still get fascinated and inspired by space exploration. It's become really popular to take selfies. This is one of the coolest selfies ever, I think. It's the Rosetta spacecraft. Is it possible to dim the lights a little bit, maybe, so we can see a little bit better? So this is the Rosetta spacecraft that's taken a picture of its own solar panel. And then in the background here, we see the comet that Rosetta is currently orbiting. And if you look very closely, you can even see this jet of gas that the comet is shooting out. Rosetta was launched all the way back in 2004, and it then spent 10 years traveling through space before it reached this comet. In order to survive those 10 years in space, we had to put it into hibernation. And it was a Danish company called Tama that not only built the electrical power supply, but also built this alarm clock that had to wake Rosetta from hibernation just prior to reaching the comet and going into orbit. Rosetta is still orbiting the comet, and every day it sends down fantastic new pictures. So if you want to see more pictures either of this comet or of Mars or any of the other things that we're currently studying, you can always go on to ESA's website. We have so many fantastic pictures there to look at. So that was just a few examples of the many, many different types of missions that we're currently working with at the European Space Agency. Our budget this year is approximately 4.5 billion euros, and that money is distributed on a lot of different programs. Our single largest program is our program for Earth observation, where Swarm is just one example of the many, many unmanned satellites that we currently have in space circling the Earth and trying to give us the knowledge that we need in order to understand our planet, the atmosphere, and the climate, and to try to understand or guess what might happen in the future in terms of climate change. And we use about a third of the budget on our Earth observation program, so all these Earth observation satellites. Those satellites, they have to get into space somehow, so we also spend a big chunk of money developing our large launch rockets, which we call Ariane. They're launched down from a place called Kourou in French Guiana in South America. And these are some of the most powerful rockets in the world, and also some of the most robust. Currently, the European Ariane rockets, they have about a 50% market share of all commercial satellites. So all the communication satellites, all the TV satellites that are launched commercially, we launch about 50% of them because it's one of the best rockets in the world. We also spend a large sum of money developing a European satellite navigation network. I'm sure you all know GPS from your mobile phones and maybe from your cars, but what you might not be aware of is that GPS is an American military system. And so it's the American military that controls it, and in theory, if war broke out, they could deny access to other countries. So here in Europe, we're currently developing a civilian version of GPS, which we call Galileo. And the first 14 Galileo satellites are already in orbit about the Earth. And hopefully within the next few years, the Galileo network will be finished and we'll be able to use Galileo in the same way that we use GPS today, or we'll be able to use Galileo and GPS together and in that way reach or achieve much higher precision in our measurements. And then, of course, we have our program for human spaceflight. That's the part of ESA that I'm working with. And there the focus currently is on the International Space Station, which is our laboratory orbiting the Earth at an altitude of about 400 kilometers and at a speed of about 28,000 kilometers an hour. With that speed, it takes the space station only about an hour and a half to fly once completely around the Earth. Or in other words, in the space of 24 hours, we see 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets from the space station. The space station today has grown enormously. It's about the size of a football field, which means it's approximately 80 meters long and almost 100 meters wide. It's so big that there's no way you can send it into space or lift it into space in one piece. So we've assembled it piece by piece, and the first piece or the first module was launched way back in 1998, and then we spent the next 11, 12 years assembling it until it looks what it looks like today. The first crew of astronauts, they moved on board the space station in November 2000, which means that for more than 15 years now, we've had people working and living in space on board the space station. And that in itself, I think, is an incredible thought. I mean, for more than 15 years now, we've had people living and working in space. So even though we might not realize it, we have become a spacefaring civilization. And this is just the first steps on our further journey into space. After the space station, we'll move further out, perhaps back to the moon or even on to Mars. But today, the focus is on the space station, which is our research station, where we can do all sorts of interesting research in physics, chemistry, biology, and physiology. And the reason that's so interesting is because we can see what happens to biological, physical, chemical processes when you remove gravity, when those processes take place in weightlessness. And the reason that's so interesting is because gravity is perhaps the only force or the only parameter here on Earth that's been constant ever since the Earth was formed. If we go 3 or 4 billion years back in time, we'd see a planet that's very different from the planet that we know today. Back then, the temperature on the surface of the Earth was different. The amount of oxygen and CO2 in the atmosphere was different. Even the strength of the sun was different back then. But the force of gravity has been constant ever since the Earth was formed. And that means, among other things, that all life here on Earth has had to adapt to gravity. And so it's very interesting to see what happens when you remove gravity and life, for example, is no longer influenced by it. And if we just look at the astronauts and their bodies in space, we see that a lot of different things happen to the astronauts. Astronauts in space typically lose muscle mass, they lose bone mass, their immune systems are compromised, even their sight or vision is affected by being in space. And it's very important that we not only understand how and why that happens, but also how we can prevent it or counteract it. Because in the future, if we want to travel further into space, if we want to travel to Mars, it's a mission that's going to take somewhere between 2 and 3 years. And so it's important for us to understand exactly what happens to our bodies when we spend that long time in space. But what's also so interesting about this research is that it gives us knowledge that benefits us here on Earth. Because being weightless is very similar to being bedridden. If you're admitted to the hospital and you're confined to a bed for several days or weeks at a time, you'll also experience a loss of muscle and bone mass that's very similar to what the astronauts experience in space. The natural aging process that many elderly people experience also has some similarities to being in space. For example, osteoporosis, which is a loss of bone density or bone mass, is very similar to what the astronauts experience in weightlessness. So again, by studying astronauts in space, we gain knowledge that we can use here on the Earth to help patients and help the elderly. Last year, 2015, and the beginning of 2016, was also a very exciting time on board the space station. It was the first time in the space station's history that two astronauts were going to spend an entire year up there. And it was a NASA astronaut named Scott Kelly and a Russian cosmonaut named Mikhail Konyenko who were launched up to the space station in March last year and didn't return until March this year. A year on board the space station is a long time, especially considering the fact that we don't have a shower. So it was a full year that Scott and Mikhail were up there without being able to take a shower. But there are also some other practical problems because the Soyuz spacecraft that we use to launch with and land with again can only stay in space for about 6 months at a time. And it has something to do with the pumps in the thermal control system that have to work continuously while Soyuz is in space. And these pumps were only designed to function for about 6 months at a time. Normally, it's not a problem because normally astronauts spend 6 months on board the space station, which means you launch in your Soyuz spacecraft and 6 months later you land in the same spacecraft again. And then while you're up there, Soyuz is docked to the space station and serves as a form of lifeboat. So in case of any emergency, in case of a fire, for example, you can always evacuate the space station return to your Soyuz spacecraft and land safely back on Earth. But because Scott and Mikhail had to spend an entire year up there, we had to send them a new spacecraft halfway through their year-long mission. And that's where my short 10-day mission came into the picture. I was launched in September last year with a new Soyuz spacecraft, which I then left up in space for Scott and Mikhail to land when 3 months ago when they landed back on Earth. And then 10 days after I launched, I landed back in the old Soyuz spacecraft that had brought Scott and Mikhail up there in March of last year. And in that way, we were able to swap Soyuz spacecraft for them. But as I said, the purpose of the space station is first and foremost research. And so I also had a full program of research that I had to complete while I was on board the space station. And we had chosen to focus on three different areas. First of all, physiology, because it's so interesting to see what happens with our bodies in space. Secondly, I had several different technology projects I had to work with. And then thirdly, I had several Danish experiments, because this was the first mission of a Danish astronaut, after all. But even before we launched, we were given a bit of a challenge. 4 or 5 days before launch, my two colleagues, Sergei, Aydin, and myself, we found out that we wouldn't be able to reach the space station in the 6 hours that it normally takes. So from the time the rocket is lit on the ground to you dock, normally, you know, it takes about 6 hours. But the orbit of the space station was not exactly where we had hoped it would be. So with the amount of fuel we had available to us, we wouldn't be able to make it up there in just 6 hours. And so we had to use a slightly older routine, which requires a little bit less fuel, but instead of 6 hours, takes 2 days. Yeah, that was a bit of a challenge, because it meant that the 10 days on board the space station, or that I would have spent on board the space station, suddenly was shortened to just 8 days. And I had to try to fit 10 days worth of work into just 8 days. And that was a bit of a challenge, of course. But it also meant that Sergei, Aydin, and I had to spend 2 days on board the Soyuz spacecraft, which is not a very big spacecraft, especially not for three big guys like us. The best way, or the best thing I can compare it to, is just sitting in your car for 2 days straight and driving, except that we don't have music, we don't have videos, we don't have books to read. We do have two small windows we can look out of. But Soyuz rotates about its axis with about 3 degrees per second. So if you look out of the windows for too long at a time, you get a little bit dizzy, which is not a good idea, especially not in the first couple of days when you're still adapting to weightlessness and you have a tendency to get nauseous and want to throw up. So there's not very much to do except just wait and try to sleep and look forward to arriving at the space station. And although it sounds strange, it was a little bit boring just sitting there for 2 days. But it also did mean that, when I finally saw the space station out of the window, it was just an incredible sight. I think we were about 50 meters from the space station when I saw these large solar panels stretch out in space next to us. And I think that was the first time when I really realized just how big the space station is today. Here on the Earth, normally when we talk about room size or house size, we talk about square meters. But in space, when you're weightless, you can move in all three directions, so square meter doesn't have much meaning. So we talk in terms of cubic meters or volume. And today, the space station has an internal volume that corresponds to a large Boeing 747 aircraft. So if you imagine 6 or even 9 people on board of a Boeing 747, you'll quickly realize that there's plenty of room for everyone on board the space station. On this picture, the space station is flying downwards, down towards the floor. So this is the front half of the space station. This is the American or international half. And here at the very front to the left, we have the European Columbus Laboratory. That's Europe's contribution to the space station. And that's where I would be spending most of my time doing all the different scientific research that I had planned. And then this back here, this is the back end. This is the Russian half of the space station. And that's where we would be docking our Soyuz spacecraft to. Now, tradition is the first thing you do when you arrive on board the space station is you have a short press conference where you talk to Mission Control Center in Moscow. And we had to do that, of course, as well. So As soon as we'd opened the hatches and greeted the six astronauts who were waiting for us, I was told that I could just continue into the next module, take a right, fly into the next module, where they had set up the cameras and prepared for this press conference. So that's what I did. I flew to my right into the next module, and then I stopped, because suddenly I couldn't recognize where I was. And I thought to myself, I can't already be lost on board the space station. Especially not because I've spent, you know, the last several years and hundreds of hours training in a model of the space station that we have here on the ground. Luckily, one of the more experienced astronauts, I think he could see that I looked a little bit confused, and he quickly told me, it's because you're standing on the ceiling. And he was right. As soon as I flipped over and I got my feet back on the floor, it was as if everything fell back into place, and suddenly I could recognize where I was. And that was the first time I experienced this disorientation that can happen when you see things from a different angle or a different perspective than you're used to. And it's something that I experienced several times during the mission. In fact, one of the funnest things I'd like to do was, instead of flying along the floor and then flying right into the next module, I would come flying along the right-hand wall so that the next module kind of was like a hole at my feet. And when I was standing at the edge of the hatch, looking into the next module or looking down into the next module, my mind would immediately make it look like this deep, dark hole that I could fall into. And even though I knew that I was weightless and I knew that if I stepped into this hole, I would just hang there in weightlessness, I still had this sensation of falling. That was really a bizarre sensation of floating there in space and then still having this feeling of falling. And it's, again, some of the confusion that happens because your mind doesn't know how to combine the sensory perceptions, in this case, the visual perceptions, with the model of the world that it's used to working with. And it's something that your mind has a lot of difficulty getting used to. Scott and Michael, who had been on the space station for about 6 months at this point, told me that it's something that they also still experience. Even after 6 months, they haven't really, their mind hasn't adapted to this. But after this press conference, I could fly straight down the middle of the space station and out into the Columbus Laboratory and start all the different work that I had to perform. And here I have a very short video that I recorded from inside the Columbus Laboratory that'll hopefully give you an idea of what it looks like in there. The video is in Danish, but there are English subtitles, so hopefully everyone will be able to follow along. Hej alle sammen, og velkommen til det europæiske laboratorie Columbus ombord på den internationale rumstation ISS. Columbus er mit hjem og min arbejdsplads gennem de næste 10 dage, som jeg skal tilbringe her ombord på rumstationen. Som I kan se, så ser det lidt rodet ud nu, og det er det også lidt, fordi jeg har alle mine personlige ting, som jeg har taget med mig. De er her i Columbus sammen med mig, og det er alt fra, ja, min danske bonusmad, lavet af den danske kok Thorsten Schmidt, til mit tøj selvfølgelig, og så vigtigst af alt, det videnskabelige grej, som jeg skal arbejde med under de næste mange dage. Og vi kan lave rigtig mange spændende forsøg her i Columbus Laboratoriet, og det spænder alt fra forsøg med væskefysik til biologiske forsøg herover, og så selvfølgelig vigtigst af alt, vores fysiologiske forsøg, hvor jeg blandt andet skal arbejde med Morris senere på missionen, og det skal jeg så bygge hele vejen herud. En sådan stor stol med en elektrisk motor, hvor jeg selv skal være forsøgskanin. Det, der også er lidt specielt ved den her mission, det er, at vi er 9 mennesker ombord på rumstationen. Normalt har hver astronaut deres egen sovekabine, men da der kun er 6 sovekabiner, så er jeg altså blevet nødt til at finde et sted, hvor jeg kan sove. Og jeg har så valgt Columbus. Det er let, for det her arbejder jeg alligevel. Og når jeg så har færdig med min arbejdsdag, ja, så kan jeg slukke lyset, og så kan jeg så ellers bare lave en koldbøtte, og så kan jeg lægge mig til at sove her. Jeg har en sovepose,
som jeg har spændt fast her på loftet, som jeg kan åbne op her. Og så ellers kan jeg bare krav ned i den. Og så ellers lægge mig til at sove her om natten. Og det er jo meget let. Så næste morgen, når jeg vågner, jamen så kommer jeg tilbage her. Og så er jeg klar til at arbejde videre. Så det var lidt om mit arbejdssted og mit hjem her ombord på rumstationen. Hej!
So what was some of the work that I had to perform on board Columbus? Well, a lot of it was focused on physiology or understanding what happens to our bodies, because quite a lot happens. In addition to losing muscle mass and bone mass, it also turns out that we actually grow in height in space. And during the 10 days that I spent in space, I grew approximately 3 centimeters in height. Unfortunately, it wasn't permanent. As soon as I landed back on the Earth, I sank back to my original height. But for some of those astronauts who are up there for half a year, they might grow as much as 6 or 7 centimeters, which is quite extreme. Why does that happen? Well, we think it's because the spine in some ways resembles a spring. Here on the Earth, gravity exerts a pressure or force that kind of compresses us and holds us together. But as soon as you're in space and weightless, that force or pressure disappears. And just like a spring, well, the spine elongates. But 6 or 7 centimeters is rather extreme, and you can get a lot of different problems. You can get back pain. Your risk later in life of discus prolapse can increase. And then there's also some practical problems, because the spacesuits that we wear when we do a spacewalk and that we wear when we land again in Soyuz, they're of course tailor-made to us. Even the seats that we sit in the Soyuz capsule when we land, they've been specially formed to us. And so if you're suddenly 6 or 7 centimeters taller, well, you might no longer fit in your own spacesuit or even in your own seat. So I had to test a special suit that we call skin suit, which I'm wearing in this picture. Most of all, it resembles a wetsuit that you might use for diving, but it has special fibers woven into the fabric, which tries to exert a longitudinal force. And in the same way that gravity does, compress our spine so that we hopefully don't grow quite as much as we otherwise would in space. What you can also see on this picture is that I'm exercising. This white box down here in the bottom of the picture, that's our exercise bike. You might just be able to see the bike pedals here. It's actually a Danish bicycle. A Danish company called Danish Aerospace Company in Odense built this bicycle, and it's one of 3 ways that we have to exercise with on board the space station. In addition to the bike, we have a treadmill for running, and we also have a strength training device where we can do everything from squats, deadlifts, bench press, abdominal exercises, everything you can imagine. For those astronauts who are in space for more than a few weeks at a time, it's a requirement that they spend 2 hours every single day exercising, because exercise is the only method that we know of today by which we can counteract or stop some of this loss of bone mass and muscle mass that astronauts otherwise would experience. So exercise on board the space station is very, very important. I also had an opportunity to work with several different robotic technologies. What we're very interested in is developing some of the technology that allow robots and astronauts to cooperate better in the future. We imagine that after the space station is done, we'll either return to the moon or perhaps send astronauts to Mars. And most likely we'll use robots to start the process of building the bases before we send astronauts to the surface. And there's in particular one technology that we're very interested in developing, which is what we call force feedback, which is the ability for the user or the astronaut to sense and feel and control the forces that a robot is exerting when completing a given task. Today, when you control a robot, it's very similar to playing a video game. You have a hand controller or a joystick, and you control the robot. But something as simple as picking up a bottle of water, which for us humans is very simple because we intuitively know how much force is required in our fingers to pick up this bottle. That can be very difficult for a robot, because a robot has no idea how much force it actually needs to apply in its fingers to pick up this bottle. And there's a big risk that the robot will just crush this bottle. But if you give an astronaut an ability to sense and feel and control those forces, well, you can solve tasks that require a lot more dexterity. And so in addition to driving this robot on Earth from the space station, I also had to use the robotic arm here to solve a few very, very simple tasks, like inserting a peg here into a board on a workbench or into a hole on a workbench over here. And I had to do that with a very simple joystick, like in this picture. But through that joystick, I could feel the forces. For example, the friction force that I had to overcome when inserting the peg into the hole. Now, you might think that that doesn't look very impressive at all. It's just a joystick. But what we're working towards is an exoskeleton robot arm like this. It's a robot arm that you essentially put on and wear. And then when you move your arm movements are sent to the robot, which follows your arm movements. And at the same time, the robot sends back the forces. So through this exoskeleton arm that you're wearing, you can feel and control the forces. And that's really exciting technology, not just in space, but also here on the ground. I mean, you can imagine a multitude of different tasks where technology here on would be useful here on Earth. It's also, I think, very exciting that it's a Danish company, again, Danish aerospace company in Odense, that's currently designing and building this exoskeleton arm that we'll be sending up to the space station within the next year or two. Some other Danish technology that I had a chance to work with is a membrane that we can use to rinse wastewater with. One of the absolute biggest challenges of spaceflight is that it's enormously expensive to send anything into space. I mean, it requires large rockets and tons of fuel. What that means is that on board the space station, we try to reuse as much as possible and recycle everything that we can. And that includes all of our wastewater, which is cleaned and turned into drinking water again. That also includes our urine, which is also rinsed and turned into drinking water again. So we typically say that the coffee we had yesterday, well, it's the same coffee we're going to have tomorrow. But rinsing wastewater like that and turning it into drinking water requires a lot of energy and, of course, a lot of chemicals. But there's a Danish company called Aquapolit, which have developed a membrane that consists of proteins similar to the proteins that we have in our bodies that help to regulate what passes in and out of our bloodstreams. And these proteins in this membrane, they only permit water molecules to pass through. So it's a method for rinsing wastewater without requiring energy or chemicals. And of course, this is very exciting technology in space on board the space station, and also in the future if we want to travel further. And of course, there's also applications of this technology here on Earth, where we also have a need to rinse wastewater. Another Danish experiment I had a chance to work with was an experiment to study or film giant lightning strikes. Giant lightning strikes that we also call blue jets and red sprites, because they're typically blue or red in color. These are lightning that shoot upward out towards space rather than down towards the ground, like the lightning that we're all familiar with. We only discovered this type of lightning by coincidence about 20 years ago, because normally when there's a thunderstorm, you know, we're standing here on the surface of the Earth below the thunderclouds, so it's very difficult to see what happens above them. But it turns out that a lot of interesting things happen. We just don't know very much about these lightning phenomena. We don't know under what conditions they're formed. We don't know how often they're formed. And we really don't know what effect that they have on our atmosphere. But we assume that they must have a certain effect, because it's an enormous amount of energy that's released. Some of these lightning strikes, they shoot all the way up to a height or an altitude of about 80 or 90 kilometers. So there's, you know, these are really large lightning strikes. We'd really like to understand more about them. And so a year or two from now, Denmark will send up its largest space mission or space instrument ever It's called ASIM, Atmosphere Space Interactions Monitor, and it's a large experiment, about 300-350 kilos, consisting of cameras and X-ray detectors that will be installed on the outside of the space station and then point down towards the Earth and then try to study these lightning strikes in better detail. It's DTU that are behind the experiment, and it's a Danish company called TAMA that's currently building this experiment. So I had to try to do a little precursor experiment. I had to try to just film or photograph some of these lightning strikes with a normal handheld camera. And I have to admit, I was a little bit skeptical because I've never seen a blue or red lightning before. And I think the researchers at DTU were also rather skeptical. I think most of all, they were hoping that I would test some of the procedures and our workflow that we will use in a year or two from now when ASIM is launched and becomes part of the space station. But one evening, I was sitting in the cupola after dinner, our large window, looking down at the Earth. And at some point, we flew over India in the middle of the night. And as I was looking down at India, this large thunderstorm started. I mean, perhaps the largest thunderstorm I've ever seen. Lightning were going off in all seven windows of the cupola. Luckily, I had my camera with me, so I started filming and photographing as much as I could. And then a few minutes later, when we had passed over it, I hurried back to my computer to look at some of the pictures that I had taken. Because this lightning or this thunderstorm was so large that I had a feeling that I had been lucky and captured something special. And it turned out that I did. And perhaps here we can turn down completely for the lighting, because some of these next pictures are very, very dark. So just to give you an idea of the size of some of this lightning and thunder, here on the right we see this gigantic thundercloud lit up by traditional white lightning that we all know from the Earth. And then just to give you a kind of a comparison, here on the left we see one of the solar panels from the Soyuz docked to the space station. Now these pictures and the video that I'll show you in just a little bit, they're on the internet. The video is on YouTube, but if you go on YouTube to look at the video, you'll also see that there is a debate raging about whether or not I've even been to space. Because some very observant people have noticed that this here looks very much like some kind of structure that you might find in a photo studio. And I've been dumb enough to take this picture without removing this structure before I took the picture. But it's not. It's actually part of the solar panel that's sneaked into the picture. Anyway, as I looked through these pictures, I became really excited because I, among other things, I saw this. And here we see some of these red sprites, this red lightning shooting up into space. And a little bit later, I also came across this. And here we see one of these blue lightning strikes, again shooting up into space. And it turned out I'd actually been so lucky to capture this blue lightning as it pulsated, as it shot out into space three times in a row, very, very rapidly. And here I have a short video that I want to show you, but you need to pay close attention because it happens very quickly. And if you blink at the wrong time, you'll miss it. So let's try. So what you want to look at is this thundercloud here on the right. And in a few seconds, you'll see this blue lightning right here, and it'll be just now. Did you all see it? Did someone blink at the wrong time? Let's try again, just in case someone blinked. So it's this thundercloud right here, and in a few seconds, you'll see this blue lightning right about here, and it's coming right now. So after the mission, I had a chance to talk to the researchers at DTU. And they told me that it's the first time that they've seen blue lightning like this, pulsating like this. So it's made them very excited. And it's incredible to know that we can still, to this day, get new knowledge about the Earth. And hopefully ASIM, when it's launched a year or two from now, will give us a lot better understanding of these lightning strikes and maybe even some fantastic photos and videos of these lightning strikes. But it wasn't just lightning that I was lucky to see. I was also really, really lucky to see Denmark from space. Because Denmark lies so far to the north that it's only when the space station comes up and turns back south over Denmark that we can see Denmark from the space station. And then, of course, you know, we also have to be honest with ourselves. It's very seldom that it's clear and cloudless in Denmark like like on this picture. But 2 days in a row, we flew over Denmark, and it was just a beautiful, clear, cloudless day. And there's something very special with not just seeing Denmark, but with seeing the Earth from space. One of the first things I noticed is that when you're flying over the day side of the Earth, like on this picture, you don't see signs of humans. You can't see cities or roads or bridges or buildings. You can't see borders between countries either. I mean, you're left with a feeling that the Earth almost is uninhabited. It's only when you fly over the night side of the Earth that you can see all of the lights from the cities light up the night sky that you realize that there are, you know, many, many people on the Earth. But on the day side, like on this picture, I mean, the Earth seems uninhabited and almost peaceful. Something else I also noticed very quickly is the contrast in color, especially the contrast between the blue color of the water and then this pitch black color of outer space that surrounds us. And if you look up in the upper left corner all the way up here, hopefully you can see this thin blue line. That thin blue line, that's our atmosphere. That's all that protects us and all other life on Earth from space around us. If that blue line disappears, it means there's no longer an atmosphere. And without an atmosphere, we can't survive, neither can any other life. For me, at least, seen in relation to the size of the Earth, that blue line seems awfully thin. And maybe because it seems so thin, it also seems fragile. Yeah, you might even get a feeling that it's something that we ought to look after and protect. Because as I said, it's the only thing that's protecting us and all other life forms on Earth from space. The only thing I didn't manage to complete during the 8 days I spent on board the space station was to send two Danish CubeSats into orbit from the space station. I brought these two CubeSats up with me, and the intent was then to launch them into space from the space station. I didn't have time for that, so some of my colleagues did that about 3 weeks after I landed. These small satellites are called CubeSats. They measure 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters, and they weigh about a kilo. They're quite small, but even though they're small, they're actual real satellites that serve a function in space. One of them was built by students at Aalborg University, and the other was built by a Danish company called GomSpace, also up in Aalborg. What the students had done was to develop and build an antenna that can receive signals that ships automatically send out to identify themselves with. So every time this satellite flies over Denmark and Greenland, it can monitor the ship traffic. And this is data that the students collect and then send onwards to Søfartsstyrelsen. And I thought this was just an absolutely fantastic opportunity for students here in Denmark, you know, to take the theoretical teaching that they get in their classrooms and use it in a practical way to build real satellite technology that's going to be launched into space and perform a function. And I just think, you know, for a student, that's just a terrific opportunity to get your hands on something and to build something and to know that what you've built is currently in orbit, sending back data to you. The other satellite from GomSpace was also very interesting. What GomSpace have found out that they can do is that they can develop an antenna that can receive the transponder signals that aircraft send out automatically. So whenever an aircraft flies, it sends out transponder signals that are picked up by control centers around the world, and that's how we monitor air traffic. But because there are no traffic, or because there are no control centers out in the Atlantic or Pacific Oceans, we have no way of monitoring air traffic there. And that means, among other things, that an aircraft like Malaysia Airlines 2 years ago could disappear without a trace. GomSpace have found out that they can actually, with their antenna, receive these transponder signals from space. So if you had a network in the future of their satellites with their antennas, you could monitor aircraft traffic all over the world, even over the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. So two very interesting Danish CubeSats that I had with me during the mission as well. And then lastly, to try to give the mission an extra Danish touch, I brought some Danish space food with me. So one evening we had a really fun time together. sharing a Danish meal and just enjoying some time off. Now, I should mention that there's a rule on board the space station, which is that you're allowed to play with your food. You have to be a little bit careful, though, because it's very easy to lose your stuff. Things have a tendency to fly away. Now here's a good question. How come the bottle of ketchup is suddenly stationary on the table? It's not because we've invented artificial gravity. It's simply because we've put strips of tape on the table. So it's a very, very simple solution, but a solution that works very well. Unfortunately, after just 10 days, it was time to return home. But the trip home is an experience in itself. It's the wildest roller coaster ride that you can possibly imagine. It starts with the capsule hitting the top of the Earth's atmosphere with close to 28,000 kilometers an hour. And at that speed, as soon as you hit the atmosphere, you generate so much air resistance that it just heats up everything around you, and the air around you turns into a plasma or an ionized gas. And so one of the first things that I noticed when I looked out the window was that the air around us had turned pink. And then this heat is so intense that you can feel it through the wall of the capsule. And we have a heat shield that's supposed to protect us. But even small pieces of that heat shield fall off and fly past the windows while it's burning up. And so when you look out the windows, you see this almost this display of fireworks. But it's only in the first few minutes that you're even able to look out of the windows. Because again, the heat is so intense that the surface of the windows begins to melt and the windows turn brown, and then you can no longer see out of them. And then we sit in our seats, and the deeper we fly down through the atmosphere, the more pressed into our seats we get, and at some point we reach what's called 4.5 G, which is means that we're pressed into our seats with about 4.5 times our own body weight, and that's something that you can feel, and that you can even hear it on our voices. The pitch of our voices change as we're talking because of this pressure. And then otherwise, we kind of sit there and wait until we reach about 10 kilometers in height. Because at 10 kilometers, that's the point at which the parachutes are released. The only thing is we don't have an altimeter, so we have no way of knowing exactly when we're at these 10 kilometers. So we kind of sit waiting for this to happen in anticipation. But when it does happen, there's just no doubt about it. Because at that point, we're still flying with somewhere around 800 kilometers an hour. And when you release a parachute at that speed, it's such a violent process. The capsule starts swinging from side to side, back and forth. And then in an attempt to stabilize this very dynamic process, we begin to spin the capsule at 13.5 degrees per second. So we're sitting inside this capsule that's swinging back and forth from side to side, and at the same time, the whole capsule is rotating like this, and it's just a wild, wild roller coaster ride that lasts a few minutes until everything has stabilized and the capsule is just gently hanging below the parachute, and everything, you know, the parachute and the capsule are falling towards the ground. Again, because we don't have an altimeter, we don't know exactly when we're going to hit the ground, so we kind of sit there again, excitedly waiting. At this time, we're trying not to talk with each other because we want to avoid having our mouth open with our tongue between our teeth, because when we hit the ground, it's with a bang. I mean, looking back, for me, it felt like we hit the ground twice. But I think the first time was when these landing rockets were ignited. These landing rockets are normally ignited about a meter off the ground. And here you can see one of the fireballs from one of them. Officially, they're called soft landing engines. I don't really know why. Because the deceleration that they cause is is so abrupt that for me it felt like we hit the ground, but then we dropped the last meter, hit the ground, the capsule tipped over, and we rolled a little bit. So it's a very violent landing. And a lot of astronauts compare it to a car crash, which I think is a good way of describing it. But luckily, apart from the shock that we get, it doesn't hurt, primarily because we're sitting in these seats that are molded to us, and we're so tightly secured in our seats that we can't move. So it doesn't hurt. We get a bit of a shock, but that's about it. And then already, 5-10 minutes later, the search and rescue crew shows up. They open the hatch, and then we can crawl out. But here I had one last surprise waiting for me, because I have to admit that I wasn't expecting that after just 10 days in space I would feel any different being back on Earth. But there I was wrong. As soon as we landed, my body felt so heavy, especially my arms and my legs. And just walking was such a chore. I really had to use my leg muscles to lift my legs and put one foot down in front of the other. I mean, it felt like I was dragging something really heavy in my hands whenever I tried to walk. My sense of balance also had to be readjusted. During the first couple of days when I walked, I had this sensation of swinging from side to side as if I had just gotten off of a boat after being out at rough sea. And it lasted a couple of days. The morning of the third day when I woke up in my own bed at home, everything was back to normal. I could no longer feel on my own body that I'd even been to space. But about a month ago, I had a chance to talk with Scott and Mikhail after their year in space, and they told me even after 2 months, they were still slowly readjusting to being back on Earth after a full year. But for me, it took about 2 days, and then everything was back to normal. So all in all, an incredibly exciting 10 days in space on board the space station with lots of interesting research and technology development during the day, and of course a lot of fun experiences at night. The space station really is a unique laboratory that we have at our disposal where we can begin to gain some of the knowledge and develop some of the technology that hopefully will take us further out into space, either back to the moon or onwards to Mars. I hope I get the chance to go back. If they offered me a chance to launch on a rocket tomorrow to go up there, I would do it without hesitation. It's just such an incredible opportunity to live and work in space. Most likely, if I get the chance to go back again, it'll probably won't be for another 4, 5, or 6 years, but I'm crossing my fingers and I'm optimistic, and I hope it works out, because I would love to go back into space. It's just an incredible experience all in all. So, thank you. Thank you. I think maybe we have time for just a few short questions. If anyone has an urgent question, yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I heard that you speak fluent Russian.
Not fluent Russian. I do speak Russian. It's a requirement today that all astronauts speak Russian because the Soyuz spacecraft that we launch and land with is a Russian rocket. So everything from our manuals, checklists, all the buttons, the flight control panel, everything is in Russian. All the voice communications over the radio with the control center is in Russian. So you have to learn to speak Russian. And strangely, my speaking Russian, if you want to talk about rockets, yeah, that's no problem. But if you want to talk about what I did last weekend, it's much more difficult for me. Yeah, so NASA's strategy has been to say that sending cargo and in the future astronauts to the space station is now a routine job that they can give to private companies, and then NASA will focus on developing the systems that will take us further out into space. So already, two private companies, SpaceX and Orbital Sciences, are currently delivering cargo to the space station, and hopefully by late 2017, early 2018, private companies will also be sending astronauts up to the space station, and that's SpaceX and Boeing who are currently working on that. So definitely private companies have a role to pay to play in space. We also see that through the smaller space tourism companies like Virgin Galactic, Blue Origins, who hope to send people just up into space, you know, 100 kilometers and then straight back down again. So I'm sure, yeah, that private companies will play an important role in the future. One last question, maybe, all the way back here.
What are you working on right now?
What am I working on right now? I'm a full-time employee of the European Space Agency, employed as an astronaut. And when I'm not training for my own mission, I'm part of the team of astronauts, which means that my primary work is in supporting the other astronauts either currently in training or already in space on their mission. So typically I work in the control center where we have a communication with the space station, where we can control the space station from. I also participate in development and especially testing of all new hardware, software procedures here on the ground before we send it into space. So the work of an astronaut is very practical, operational in nature, and most of it is in terms of supporting functions, you know, making sure that the missions of the other astronauts are a success as well. Yeah. One last question? Okay.
Yeah, what's the part of poetry in space?
Sorry? How much poetry is involved? That's a good question. I mean, that's very much up to the individual astronaut, I think. I mean, astronauts are just like all other people. We have a range of interests. Some astronauts are interested in literature and poetry. Others in different types of art. I brought I didn't show a picture of it, but I brought a portrait made from a Portuguese street artist who normally makes this very visual portraits of people on the sides of buildings. And so he created a portrait that I hung up in the cupola so that it was backlit by the Earth. So every time, you know, as we're flying over the Earth, you see the blue and the white and the red from the land passing underneath it. It lit up this portrait. So yes, there is, but it's up to the individual astronaut, essentially. Yeah. Thank you.